All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Doug Thornton. You are watching the American Vindicta Show. For all you who are on a podcast listening, we have a great guest in today, Mr. Chris Pinto. He's an author, he's a filmmaker, and he's also quite the historian on American history, more especially Christian American history. And we're going to be talking about what happened recently with the active shooters. It's still a lot of things are coming out about this. We need to continuously explore this topic because, and I'm sure Chris probably believes in the same thing, there is quite a bit of information that's out there that is inaccurate to a extent, and then also very much used to inflame people. And the incendiary comments from the left and people on the right is just making the entire nation go emotionally unstable. So we're going to talk about that, and then we're going to talk about the last topic we got into the last time Chris was here, Civil War. And why do active shooters and the destruction of our laws and also the threat to the Second Amendment, why does that lead potentially to a civil war? So, Chris, the board is yours.
Well, I think this is a very important topic. It's one that a lot of people have talked about for many years. And this is one of those things. I mean, in terms of looking at what could possibly happen that would lead us into a civil war, the one thing that I think could do it would be the one thing that led to the American Revolution, because there were all sorts of conflicts that were happening in our country over violations of Magna Carta, where, you know, they're shouting no taxation without representation. That was Magna Carta. Then the Intolerable Acts, where they're housing British troops in people's homes, which was a violation of the Petition of Right of 1628. But it was when it came to confiscating arms from the colonists, that was the line in the sand where they said, thus far and no farther. And that's where it came to blows. There were a lot of other things that happened before that, you know, the tax on tea, et cetera. Then you had the Currency Act. There were all kinds of issues that were being debated that people were riled up about. But it was when they went to disarm the colonists, that was where they said, okay, this is an act of war. And to understand it, I think you have to go back to the Glorious Revolution of 1688 and what had happened there, where King James II had disarmed the people of England, took their guns away. He was Catholic, and he disarmed the Protestants, who were the majority. And they didn't like that. And so they brought in William and Mary, who invaded the country. They took over as the new monarchs, and they chased James out. And then they drafted the English Bill of Rights of 1689, which contained the right to bear arms. And that's really what King George was violating. But that was seen as a fundamental right, really a right that goes back to Magna Carta. There's a great article online with the William and Mary Law Review where they taught the article is called something like Magna Carta and the Right to Bear Arms. And you read it, and then they talk about Article 61 in Magna Carta. Article 61 specifically gave the barons and the people the right to resist the king by force if the king did not obey the Great Charter. Okay. And so, as they say, the right of revolution was hence written into English law for the first time. And that was handed down for centuries. And you find Blackstone, really, you find John Locke writing about it. It's why the English Civil War happened. It's why the Glorious Revolution happened. It's why Locke is writing about it. And then Blackstone has, if you read Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, there's a whole section there called the right of revolution, because that is considered a God-given right, one that you find in the Bible, because in the Bible, you have many examples of kings who are being resisted and opposed when they fall into corruption and evil. And so the reformers generally believed this. Luther believed it. Knox believed it. The Puritans certainly believed it. And it's really the inspiration for our Declaration of Independence, where it says we have rights that come from God. Those rights are unalienable. Governments are instituted among men to secure these rights, and that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. The alter and abolish clause in the Declaration is basically an Americanized version of Article 61 from Magna Carta, if that makes sense.
So in Old English common law, it also covered what type of weaponry, even to the extent of body armor, that a person was not just should have on hand, supposed to have on hand, to the extent that it could be a capital punishment if you did not have these items and the state inspected your home and you were found not having them. Not even if you weren't called up to arms, but they would even inspect the homes and say, mm-hmm. hey, you're supposed to have a cuirass, you're supposed to have a buckler, at least a helmet, some sort of a pauldrons. And then it would just, you know, it would evolve with weaponry, pole arms, bows and arrows. If you're a slingman, how many shots, lead shots and slings you're supposed to have,
mm-hmm.
even to the extent, what was the age for the men in the home? Did it start at 14 or 16?
That I don't know. I'm not sure the exact age, but I do know that typically our ancestors believed that young men should be trained in arms from a very early age. Now, I'm not sure where the age of accountability would have been, either probably 18 or 20.
Yeah, I could have swore at some point that they had talked about 16 and then it drafted to 18 years old. But just imagine how many 18-year-olds in this country right now own weapons and don't own weapons, but know how to use them properly within a martial status. Not many.
Right. And you know, that whole, the issue of it being not just a right, but originally it began as a duty. It was like paying a tax. Nobody thinks about their right to pay taxes. You don't think that way. It's your duty to pay taxes. And that's how it was seen for centuries going back to King Alfred. And part of the reason, brother, is because when we read the Bible, you have multiple examples of people being condemned by God and by the prophets and by the people in the Old Testament if they refuse to go to war. All right. So you have, for example, in the book of Judges, if you go to Judges chapter 4, where you read about Deborah and Barak, and they fight Sisera and the kings of the Canaanite kings there in the land of Canaan. And they defeat Sisera, and then you have Jael, who takes a tent spike, nails it into Sisera's head, kills him.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterwards, you have the Song of Deborah. It's said by some historians that the Song of Deborah was one of the most preached on parts of the Old Testament for about 150 years from the English Civil War all the way through the American Revolution. There are some historians who have said that. But what happens is at one point, there's a curse pronounced on the people of ancient Meroz, okay, which was a city or a town in somewhere in Israel where the people refused to come out to war. And so in the Song of Deborah, it says, "Cursed be Meroz, says the angel of the Lord, curse bitterly the inhabitants thereof, for they did not come to help the Lord against the mighty." And you had ministers in this country that preached on that refusal to go to war. You have at the end of the book of Judges, when you have the Benjamite War, where the Benjamites had gang raped a woman and raped her to death, and she was a married woman, and they killed her because they abused her all night. And then when the other tribes of Israel find out about it, they all send men there to hold the Benjamites accountable. And they say, deliver up the men who have done this so we can put them to death. Benjamites said, no, we're not going to do it. that led to a war. Well, when the war ended, they asked the question, they say, well, from which of the towns did they not send any men? And then there was a certain town that didn't send any men. So they sent the men to that town that failed to show up. And all of the men in that town were put to death for failing to show up for this battle. Okay. You have the account where Moses approaches Gad and Reuben in the Old Testament. This is after they'd been in the wilderness. They'd been wandering the wilderness for almost 40 years. And Gad and Reuben had gotten comfortable with their families on the other side of the River Jordan. And they'd established farms and so on. They were living the good life. And somehow or other, Moses got wind of the idea that they were not going to go to war. So he confronts them and he says, will you sit here while your brethren go to war? And he says, if you do that, you're going to weaken the hands of your brethren. They're going to be upset. And this is what had happened, Moses said, years earlier when the children of Israel refused, when the spies came back from the land and they saw the giants and they brought up an evil report on the land. They said, oh no, they're too big. They're too powerful. We're all going to get killed. And what's going to happen to our children? And so then the people became fearful and they refused to go to war. And Moses says, you're going to cause the same kind of reaction from your brethren in Israel. And so then they say, Gad and Reuben, they say, no, Moses, we'll go to war. Don't worry, we'll go to war just as you've asked us to do. And Moses says, okay, if you go to war, as you've said, then you will do well. But if you don't, then bear in mind that you have sinned against the Lord and be sure your sin will find you out.
Mm-hmm.
That's where that phrase comes from. That's where that verse comes from. It came specifically from a refusal to go to war, or at least the thought. I mean, because they never actually refused to go to war. Let me say that correctly. They ultimately agreed to go, but somehow, and the scripture doesn't tell us how, somehow Moses got the impression that they were not going to go. So somebody must have told him something, but he confronted them specifically, and Moses is telling them that it would be a sin for them to refuse to go to war with their brethren. But we find this over and over and over again throughout the scripture. In Jeremiah, God says, when he commands war, cursed is he who keeps back his sword from blood. There's actually many verses in the scripture condemning people who refuse to go to war when God commands his people to go to war. You have kings like King Ahab and King Saul who were condemned for refusing to execute judgment against evildoers. You know, King Saul refused to put to death King Agag, the Amalekite king, and he was condemned for it. And then you have King Ahab, he refused to put to death Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, and then God condemned him for it and said he was going to be overthrown. He was going to lose his throne because he had failed to execute judgment against Ben-Hadad. Now, when I look at all of this, brother, because I have to admit, this is, you know, when you actually go and you start studying the scripture and you measure it against what we're so often being told in the modern evangelical world, that, you know, even though we're being told that war is bad, and obviously we don't necessarily want war. You know, you don't want war. People want to live peaceably. And the Bible says we should pray for those who are in power and authority in government so that in as much as is possible, we can dwell peaceably during our time upon the earth, for this is right and pleasing in the sight of God. There's no question about that. So we don't believe in warmongering or anything like that. But the scripture does say the Lord is a man of war. And Jesus says, think not that I came to send peace on the earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword and division.
Mm-hmm.
That if you take a stand for the gospel of Christ and for the commandments of God and the law of God, there are going to be people, there are going to be powers out there that are going to be angry. They're going to be furious about it. And you look at the issues that caused the greatest division in our country, those issues you can trace to the commandments of God. You and I were talking about this before the program, talking about God's authority, the authority of Christ, God's law, all the issues that the radical left is shouting and screaming about and against and so on, all have to do with the stand of conservative Christianity historically on certain moral issues that have their point of origin in the Bible. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Whether it's the abortion issue, whether it's LGBT, whether it's, you know, what they're doing now with transgenderism, whether it's doing with even border laws. Border laws you find in the Bible going back to ancient times as part of the common laws that God has given to all the nations. We read about it in Genesis, read about it in Deuteronomy, etc. And so now we're being told open borders, we should have open borders, and we have people on the left acting like America is some strange anomaly because we believe in having borders and defending them, which is something that every country in the world does. You see what I'm saying? But it's very, very biblical. God sets boundaries in the scripture, and you have kings and you have ministers and so on setting boundaries. And if you look at just that very issue in the Bible, if you violate certain boundaries, you can be put to death for it.
Yeah.
You'd be executed.
Well, let me ask you a question. In the realms of what the Bible teaches us with cowardice, not responding to the call of arms, mm-hmm. there's a lot going on right now about this last active shooter in Uvalde. And the information is constantly being updated. So, you know, I don't stick to any thesis yet until I have all the information. Like I said, I want the totality of these circumstances completely explained. But there's a bit of a problem that reportedly the officers did not go in immediately upon finding the shooter. And I wonder, because, you know, right now the nation is condemning law enforcement. As usual, we get condemned for everything, and I'm prior law enforcement, so, you know, I still back the blue, and I still bear the brunt of a lot of that. But my problem is that if these officers did go in, or if they didn't go in, if they did go in and all this other stuff still occurred, it's just tragic. I don't know what else to say. But if they didn't go in, what is the calling upon God's people for not responding in this present day to an attack like that? What do you think about that?
You mean for if, like assuming that the police officers were Christians, is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Oh, I think they, you know, I think about what God says in Ezekiel to the watchman. You know, he's got a watchman on the wall, and he says, if the watchman sees the sword come and he does not sound the trumpet, and the sword comes, you know, the enemy comes and invades and takes away any man, you know, kills anybody, that God says he's going to hold the watchman accountable for that blood. Why? Because the watchman had a duty. His job is to stand on the wall, keep watch. If he sees the enemy coming, he's got to sound the alarm. So if he doesn't do that, if he doesn't perform that responsibility, then God holds him accountable. I think the same would apply if law enforcement officers, if they have a duty to protect, and it's their job to go in and confront a shooter like that to protect these kids, assuming that's their responsibility. Now, I don't understand all of the policies where the police are concerned, but just in a very simple way, if that's their duty and they didn't do it, yeah, there would be accountability. You could argue that God would hold them accountable for the blood of the innocents who were killed.
So the reason why I asked that is if there was a policy somewhere that stopped these responding officers from going in, and instead they set up a cordon, wait for special teams and special weapons and special gear to show up, and then they breach the school, and then they engage with the shooter. The meantime, while that's happening, you hear the bullets and you hear the screaming. You know children are dying. As a Christian, I would just say, well, screw that order. Who's going with me? We're breaching. I would find a way in. Now, I'm armchair quarterbacking this, which is, it's very taboo within the realms of law enforcement. And even though that I am a use of force instructor, I do review cases like this. I know the way the tactics are supposed to be. And I could argue both sides as to why I would wait for special weapons and special teams and shields, because if I have to cross this gap of a clear distance where there's no obstructions, there's no obstacles for me to seek cover behind, I'm going to get shot too. And then I just caused more of a problem. I took another gun out of the fight. So tactically, I can think like that. But at the same time, that's where the heroism is supposed to come in. That's where you're supposed to be able to grab that inner part of you. That's the reason why you put on the shield, you wear the badge and the gun, and you just got to run. Just like in the sands of Iwo Jima, you just got to go. You got to go until you get to the pillbox and destroy the first objective. Sometimes within the realms of law enforcement, that's just what we have to do. But here's a problem, Chris, and I'm reading a lot of comments and people aren't really well in tuned with all this. You cannot just fire into a building and have supportive fire like we do in the military and then have another group of guys coming around, because you're responsible for every single round and where that round impacts. And if that round hits a child or a teacher, you're responsible for it. So that's mm-hmm. why we don't have covering fire like that. There are ways around covering fire that we do find creatively, but there are many different tactics and things we could be doing. My real goal here is to explore why someone would not go in. And as a Christian man who's also law enforcement, what are the repercussions for us, not just on the court of public opinion, but within the court of Christ? Because that's our calling as peacekeepers and peacemakers. That is your job. You are going to be mm-hmm. in a very dangerous situation, and there's a level of bravery there that you have to tempt every now and then. So, I want to be able to kind of give a new aspect upon this, Chris, because the rhetoric is really terrible right now. People are saying, everybody's anti-cop again. I understand why the parents and people that are around the parents.
Well, they're saying that one of the reports that I've read, and I'm not sure if it's true or not, maybe you can confirm it. One of the reports that I've seen in some of the headlines is that parents were actually pleading with the police officer saying, please go in there and save our kids. And for some reason they didn't go.
So what's confusing about this, and once again, this is the problem, just like with the war in Ukraine, we get bits and pieces of intelligence. Mm-hmm. And it's one reason why even within the court of law, film is not always the best evidence, because you give a one visual perspective and you don't have the totality of the circumstances of what's going on before, during, or after. All you see is this narrow scope from the film. So to me, what that looked like was officers who were sitting on a cordon that is a outer exterior perimeter. All that means is we don't want people getting into the crime scene, and we don't want, if possible, the shooter to leave the crime scene. So that's what the exterior perimeter is there for. There would also probably be an interior perimeter that is moving EMS and survivors back and forth, which from what the DPS, Texas DPS, said, that was occurring. So, it really comes down to probably within the next 48 hours, somebody who was there, who made the initial engagement with the shooter, who shot the shooter. He was a agent with the Border Patrol. He was on their BORTAC unit. I've worked with BORTAC for a long time. They're great guys. When you shoot somebody, You have typically about 72 hours where you don't write a report. You just write down everything as you remember as everything's happening. Because immediately after the shooting, the adrenaline dump, you have audio and visual exclusion where you may get in the tunnel vision. You may not remember everything immediately. So it takes, you know, you're given typically 3 days to recall all your memory and talk your way through what happened in a report. I'm waiting for that report to come out so that we know just exactly what happened, because what I want to know is who called 911. When was it reported? What time approximately did the shooter enter into the school? And then what time did law enforcement engage? And what time did law enforcement breach? And then what time after that did law enforcement engage with the shooter again inside the school, then stopping it? Those are little missing pieces of information that will put all this back together. Because right now, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say the story that you mentioned, the border guard, the off-duty border guard guy. The story that I read, he was getting a haircut or something at a barber shop and heard what was going on. His daughter apparently was going to the school where this was happening. He borrows a shotgun from the guy running the barber shop, takes a shotgun, runs into the school, ignores whatever warnings were there, and he goes in there and finds his daughter and rescues her and a number of other kids, gets them to safety. And the reports I've seen, he was the guy who actually shot mm-hmm. and put down this this crazy, you know, shooter that went in there and committed this horrible crime.
Yeah, he also got shot in the head. It was a grazing blow right across the top of the head. Yeah.
Yes, I saw the photos of that. But he lived through it. And I mean, that guy's a hero. I mean, that guy's a real hero. He not only saved his daughter, he saved other kids. He put this guy down. He ignored whatever protocol was there. And I think his motivation had to be, this is his child. You know, his child was on the line and he was there, I think, to save her and also anybody else he could save. I think the guy was a real hero.
Yeah, I do too. That's why I'm so confused, because the way I was trained and the way federal law enforcement, I know for a fact, is trained. I can't mention anybody else law enforcement wise, but I know federal law enforcement wise, pre-Columbine, during a shooting, everybody shows up, you set a big cordon and you wait for special teams. I was a special teams guy. So you would wait for all of us to show up and then we would breach and, you know, whatever we had to do. Post-Columbine, they developed a policy, but a new type of tactic that's called Immediate Action Rapid Deployment, IARD. So with Immediate Action Rapid Deployment, it means even if it's just a trickle-down effect of officers showing up, if you're the first guy, you're now incident commander, you're in charge of the scene. That means you're in charge of coordinating everything. You're in charge of getting all the basic information out there until someone of rank shows up. And then they are now placed into the incident commander role. And like I said, with a trickle-down effect, however many officers from whatever units that are out there start to show up, you just meet each other, gather in a team, and you breach, you make entry, or you rendezvous with people while they're inside the school. You're not to wait. We're all trained on a standard of how to clear a room, of tactical proficiency with room clearing and with how to handle active shooters. So there's no excuse as to why you can't team up with another group of guys or gals and then all, you know, be one cohesive unit and then start clearing out the rooms and finding the shooter and neutralizing them. Even to the point that that's one of the reasons why 10 code talks. I know you people hear 10-4 and all this other stuff. That's called 10 codes, cop talk. We kind of do away with that for active shooter, and we have just plain speech where, hey, you know, Chris, this is Doug. I'm on this side of the room. Go to that door on the other side. There's not, you know, hey, 10 this and 10 that. We're, you know, it's plain talk. Because you don't know who you're working with. So let's just talk normally to each other. But the problem comes in is that if you have multiple different departments, and then you throw in some federal agencies with their and state agencies that are responding. We're not all on the same radio frequency. There may be, you know, some sort of a frequency hop that you could go to for a district or a regional frequency, but not everybody has that. Some people have different types of radios that, you know, have different higher bands within how these radios are used. So not everybody can talk on the radio. So what that ends up happening is I got to use my cell phone, where somebody has to be a runner and has to be running back and forth, bringing information back. And that's very dangerous, but you roll with what you have. But we're trained to a certain standard that you should know what to do during this situation. Just like with the shooting in Parkland, that school resource officer had the training to know what to do. He just didn't do it. Mm. Or if he did do it, he didn't do it to the best of his ability. I don't care, whatever Parkland, it's in the past now. So let's focus on Uvalde. Whatever it is that happened, we're going to know the truth about it. The problem that, and I agree with almost everybody who's talking about this, the problem right now is that it seems that the stories are changing, but the stories may be changing because the intelligence is trickling in and it is changing the story. The incident is being updated. And what the left does is the left will say, look, they're changing the story. The cops didn't do anything. They're lazy. They're cowards. They allowed all these children to die. And then the parents who are stuck on this outer perimeter, the shooting may have already been done by the time they showed up. And like I said, I don't know. I wasn't there. I'm only gathering the intelligence as I get it. But if you're just showing up, and obviously to this tragedy, everybody's going to freak out. Everybody's going to want to go in. If it was you or I, we'd be wanting to go in. I'd probably get arrested because I'm going to bulldozer my way into there and I'll have a gun on me. So then that makes me now a potential threat for law enforcement, because I'm emotionally unstable. I want to get my kid. I'm going to enter an active crime zone. And also I'm armed, so I can't be allowed in. So that's why some parents were detained. It doesn't make sense to the average person who doesn't understand tactics, who doesn't understand law enforcement procedure and why we don't allow civilians to enter into these scenes. Even though to some extent, hey man, if I showed up to an active shooter and then I had Joe Blow on the side of the street get out with his deer rifle, hey, you come with me. There's a shooting. I don't care who you are. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. But
that's the way I think. And just because that's the way I think doesn't mean that's the way people do it. I have demonstrated for about 10 years my frustration with law enforcement and why we do things wrong many of the times, and why and it's not really on the lower level with the street officers. It's the higher level where you have people who want to play politician, and what they'll do is they'll create a new policy because it makes them look cool on a resume. And that policy will restrict what an officer can do, even though law supersedes policy and says, hey, officers, you can do any of these things as long as you're reasonably objective with your use of force. And then policy will say, well, we don't want to be sued, so you can't actually do all these things. So that's part of the problem that we see. And I just want to know what it is that happened. If nobody went in while all these kids were in there being shot, who gave the order? Who was the senior man or woman who said, nope, we're going to wait for special units to show up, and you can sit here and you can hear the shooting going on? That is alien to me. And to most of the officers that I've worked with, that's alien.
Going back to the Christian perspective on this and the historical perspective, one of the most influential documents in the entire Western world is the Westminster Confession of Faith, something we talk about in my film, True Christian History. And Dr. Peter Hammond, in fact, comments on this, how in the Westminster Confession, you have the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. Okay. Thou shalt not kill, and that there's two sides of that command. And the one side is obviously you as an individual cannot wrongfully take the life of another human being. You can't commit murder. Okay. But then there's the other side. The other side is a duty that we have as Christians to prevent murders from happening or prevent murders from happening. So on the one hand, we can't commit that crime, but it's also a duty that God has given to prevent that crime from happening, because God follows it, you know, as he did when Noah and his family got off the ark. And he said, if man sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. So man is held responsible to execute capital punishment against murderers. So that right there shows an accountability that, if there's some murder out there running around, we as God's people have a measure of accountability to deal with that. We can't just sit back and let murders happen. We have a responsibility to prevent them. I mean, you can now, once you begin with that and you start looking at situations like Nazi Germany or the situation in Russia with the Bolsheviks and their gulags and so on, or these totalitarian, tyrannical forms of government that are murdering millions of people. Yes, it all comes back to what our forefathers believed, that there's the right, there's God-given rights on the one hand, but something that our ancestors wrote about that I think we don't talk enough about, rather, in modern times, is our duty. That word duty. What is our duty before God? And I think that sounds like what you're getting at with, you know, these police officers, and should they have gone in? Why did they hang back? You know, there was that whole incident with Broward County years ago, and the one officer did not go into the school while a shooting was happening. They called him the coward of Broward, or the Broward coward. I think it's part of natural law. There's something in our hearts and our minds. You know, the scripture says, Romans chapter 2, that God's law is written on the hearts of all men. To some extent, we know that we have a responsibility. When we see that kind of evil happening, we know that we have a duty to do what we can to prevent it.
So you know what a problem with this is that there's this thing called liability. And you have policymakers, and I have been told this. You have policymakers who typically are weasels and scum, and they're typically also of the lawyer class. And no offense to lawyers, but the ones that I know, I wouldn't give them a shovel and depend on a ditch to be dug. But they were telling us, this is, you know, many years ago, that because we're federal, as we're driving down the road from, you know, wherever we're going from one area to another, our jurisdiction is not on the road, obviously, unless it's an emergency. But if there was like a bus filled full of people that had flipped over and, you know, bodies are all over the place, do I have the right and the duty to stop and render aid? And we were told, no, actually, you don't. You should probably just keep going. And then we just all kind of stopped and we looked at each other and like, well, you can go to hell. We're not going to stop. Or we're not going to just keep going. We're probably going to stop and render aid because we're human. And that mentality at the federal level is so very dangerous to me, because they try to dehumanize officers just like they did in Nazi Germany. They try to dehumanize officers and they say, oh, well, you know, you don't have a duty to do this. You don't have a duty to do that. The one thing I do know within law enforcement is you don't have a duty to retreat. You do not have a duty to retreat. If there is a shooting, it is your job to go and stop the threat. That's why you're trained. That's why you're given the power to put people into the dirt. I see a government now, though, Chris, that is very wholesomely unchristian, that is having its authority givers tell the men and women who enforce the authorities we're no longer a Christian nation. So they're kind of bending the rules here as to what we would say is right and wrong within the realms of law enforcement. Because I always say, you know, where did law enforcement come from? I trace it back to the Bible. Law enforcement comes from the Bible, enforcing the laws as what God had stated upon us, as you also just said. The moment that we start changing all that, you can take law enforcement and turn it to a very devious thing, a very devious, malicious entity. And not only that, but you erode an already eroding beach into the trust of law enforcement. I think, honestly, if I had my way, I would almost have a Christian test for anyone who is put within the realms of law enforcement or within the realms of the hierarchy of law enforcement, because then there's a level of accountability there that you should be holding yourself spiritually with God. And not only that, but now also forcefully with the laws that you're supposed to be enforcing, the policies that you're writing should be influenced by God. They're not anymore. They're not, especially within the three-letter agencies, more especially within the intelligence communities. They are not responsible in their own eyes to Christ anymore. It's turned very malicious. And not saying that officers are malicious or you know, workers of iniquity. I'm just saying, like, the whole idea of law enforcement within America, Chris, it's changing. And we have a tragedy like what happened in Uvalde. And that erodes trust more and more. Eventually, and my wife and I got into a heated debate about this. And, you know, emotionally, she may be right. And calculatively, I may be wrong. But she believes that if we continue to see stuff like this happening, we're going to see a people turned on law enforcement. And at that point in time, what we've been trained for so many years, honestly, would be complete. In law enforcement, at least within the academies, you are taught to a certain example of a we versus them mentality. You know, we being law enforcement versus the civilian population that we're supposed to be policing and protecting. But it's the policing part or the protecting part that gets kind of confused every now and then. Because a lot of times the way the intelligence communities brief us and the way higher ups will brief us, it makes it seem like the people are the enemy and law enforcement is its own group of people now. And that within itself, and I've seen this happen, pits people against one another. And then you have all these other tragedies pitting people one another. Chris, it's just one more of an element to civil war. What do you think?
No, I think you're right. I think, you know, you mentioned lawyers, and as soon as you mention the fact that these certain lawyers said to you guys that if you're driving down the road and you see an accident or something, and then the lawyer says you have no duty to stop and help and this kind of thing. That's something that has been going through the courts. This issue has come up. And again, it's the courts. It's not the legislators, from what I understand. The big problem is the way the courts and the judges, the lawyers are making certain arguments, the judges are accepting them, and then it's being considered law when it's not really law. It's just a court decision. But there have been rulings to the effect that the police have no certain duty to protect the people. That is, and it's not clear, because there's other rulings where they acknowledge that the police do have to protect the people. It's this inconsistency that exists in the system. But it gets to a fundamental principle of law that was written in the Declaration of Independence, and that is protection and obedience. The government must protect, and in return, the people obey. Because King George would not protect the colonists, according to the law, they said he's abdicated government. In other words, he's no longer an authority to be obeyed because he won't protect the people. You see what I'm saying? He was allowing the people to be victimized, whether by the Indians, by redcoats, by corruption going on in government, the rule of law was not being upheld. And that was why they said that in the declaration. And so as I've observed this for the past couple of years, I've been sort of, and I would encourage anybody, I would encourage all Americans to investigate the protection and obedience principle in government, because that's the principle that all the great wars were always fought over. That is the government going to protect or not? We look at what's happening in our country. Is the government protecting us from millions of illegals who are coming in? Drug dealers, criminals, thugs, people bringing in these poisonous drugs into our country that are killing thousands of people a year. It's been reported that terrorists are coming into our country through the southern border. Is the government protecting the people from this? No, they're not. They're just letting them come in. Hey, come on in. Is the government protecting us from election fraud, from having these millions of illegals vote in our election? No, they're encouraging them to vote, even though it's a violation of our national sovereignty. You know, it's almost like saying you're going to let somebody take your credit card and go charge whatever they want on it, that the government's not going to protect your right to your own property, which would be, you know, your finances, your home, et cetera. America, our country, is the private property of the American people. And I think open borders is a form of pure communism. They're trying to destroy private property ownership. They're just doing it in kind of a roundabout way. But the government is, you know, like with Black Lives Matter, when they ran all over the country, burning down businesses, destroying neighborhoods, pulling down monuments, smashing up cars on the freeway, assaulting people. The police were being told to stand down in these blue states and blue cities, especially. In other words, they were being told, don't protect the people, don't protect the businesses, don't protect anyone from these wild mobs that are going and running wild. That's why I think this issue of protection and the government's duty to protect, not just the police, because I don't think the fault is nearly as much the police as much as it is the politicians who are manipulating them and telling them what to do and what not to do.
Absolutely. Let me give you an example of that. And, you know, people are probably getting really tired of me talking about Portland. The reason, once again, why Portland really is a foundational stone for the true domestic terrorism problem that we have in America is that when President Trump ordered us to go to Portland, we went there under the guise of protecting a federal courthouse that was being attacked, not the people. So when we go there to protect anything federal, we're protecting the people that are on and off of the property within a certain amount of distance off the property as well, but also the employees that are U.S. citizens, federal employees inside. So we're here protecting a courthouse, and from the courthouse, it turned to various other federal buildings within Portland, most notably the immigration office that's off of, the immigration office that's off of McAdam. And we ended up fighting almost an eighth to a quarter of the population of that dang city. To an extent, that's how many people would show up. And they were backed by politicians. They were backed by the mayor. They were backed by lawyers, by the attorney general, the district attorney, then also by the governor. But then the president would say, federal forces, you protect these buildings and you kick those people's asses every time they show up. And that's what we did until Biden got in office. And then the leash got put back on us. And that's when you really saw corruption come back to life. You know, to an extent, Trump was a reprieve, not completely, but to an extent. To an extent, he allowed law enforcement to do his job, but it really was a battle between the Republicans and Democrats at that point. And we were just a political tool. Now that that man's out of the way, and Biden's in office, we have all these things going on with the shooters. We have the politicians already drafting bills introduced into the House for removing police from schools, and then Chuck Schumer wanting to remove the Second Amendment. Biden wants to remove the Second Amendment. They want to install the universal background check, which is complete BS. You get your background check every time you go there to buy a weapon if you're buying it legally.
Yeah, I'm trying to. I still can't figure this out. How and they for years they've said the gun show loophole and whatever. There's no gun show.
Yeah, I've been to gun shows. It's the same thing. Hey, I want to buy this gun. Okay, well, I got a call, and you got to do a background check. You still got to fill out a form. Still got to go to the ATF. You know, and you still get your background check done.
Exactly.
You know, it's not the most perfect system, but it's better than anyone else's. You know,
well, not only that, but the Democrats and there was this coach that got up and he's talking about, well, we need to do the background checks and this kind of thing. We are doing the background checks. They're legally purchased firearms. My understanding is there's nowhere in the country where you can legally purchase a firearm without a background check. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
So this is part of, I think, the psychological warfare. Because they know, they have to know that this is not a problem, and yet they keep going over it as though, Republicans and gun owners are trying to prevent background checks. No, we're not. It's
there's something more nefarious to this. They don't want to repeal the Second Amendment. They want to demasculate the Second Amendment. What they are after. And I've seen it when they do this. I've seen whenever they introduce these House bills, what they're after is anything that's behind me. They're after all semi-automatic weapons, shotguns, rifles, pistols. They will allow you to have a flintlock, black powdered rifle, or a single shot pistol, rifle, or shotgun. The pistol can't weigh more than like 50 grams, so you can't have a high caliber, big bore round pistol like a 454 Casull or 44 Magnum or higher. You'll be ground down to like a 380, right? You know, we've shot at dogs in Iraq and 9mm didn't kill them. So, you know, and the 380 is not going to help me either. They want to completely take away your ability. This is my personal opinion, to be able to combat the government. The government will not lose anything behind me. We'll get more of them. We'll get more M4s, more semi-automatic weapons, longer range, better ballistics, better body armor. They want to limit body armor. You can't own body armor either because all the shooters have body armor now. Well, you know what, Chris? There's a reason why we're trained to a certain standard of how to defeat body armor called two to the chest, one to the head. All right. There are ways that we train from the military and law enforcement on how to defeat body armor. If he's got on body armor, if you can't hit him in the T-box, shoot him in the groin. That'll stop you. That'll have a bad day, right? You'll bleed out. But it's asinine that members of the political groups who, you know, 99% of them have zero experience with guns. They have zero experience with serving their country while carrying a gun, but yet they want to tell the American citizens, you and I, not so much me as a veteran and as someone who's also a former police officer, Chris, they want to tell the average Americans, the good old boys, you can't have your daddy's hunting rifle anymore. That is how you start a civil war in this country. You know, this is what's sad. We've almost completely taken God out of our government and out of our courts. During the lockdowns, we'll just say the lockdowns because YouTube will ban us if we say anything else. They banned you from going to church. They are indoctrinating your children into being radicals. They're changing history. That's a big thing for you and I. We're history buffs. Oh, yeah. Changing history. That's extremely deadly for the new generations of kids. They're poisoning your water, poisoning your food. They want to take away your guns. And then they also want to tell you that they're all doing it for your own good. But it is we, the people, who hold the power, not those, the politicians. And I think the point of this is to drive as many wedges into the foundation stone that is we the people that holds up America. You know how you split a big, big stone? What you do is you take wedges and you hammer them into that stone. And so eventually it cracks in half or into multiple pieces. With every new law, every new policy, with every new strike against the Constitution, it's another wedge being drove into the foundation stone of America, which was made off the backs of we the people. And eventually, we're going to be at each other's throats, and then against the police, and then against the government. And it's the perfect ways, the perfect model for civil war. And I think we got 10 minutes left. And eventually, that civil war gets to the point that the government loses so badly, they have to call in foreign forces. I think that's the eventuality. What do you think?
Well, I think you could be right. Certainly calling in foreign forces, that's something we've heard about. I mean, I've heard that for 20 years, that they've had foreign troops training on American soil, planning to help with gun confiscation, et cetera. It goes back a long way. People have talked about that. I do believe, however, brother, that they do want to repeal the Second Amendment. And I even printed out a copy of this article from the Jesuit magazine, America, the Jesuit Review. This is from February 2013. Hold on. February 2013, repeal the Second Amendment. That's the headline. I don't know if anybody can see that. Can you make it out?
Yep.
Read it? Okay. Okay. I would highly recommend anybody to go and read that article, because you're going to see from there some of the groups that I think are chiefly instrumental in all of this, the Jesuits and the Catholic bishops, because a lot of the point men, Joe Biden, Beto O'Rourke, Nancy Pelosi, a lot of those leaders have all direct links to the Vatican and the Jesuit order. Okay, if you study them, Obama, he's another one. And yes, they. If you read this whole thing, they talk about how back in 1976, District of Columbia enacted, I'm reading this now, enacted one of the nation's toughest gun control laws. The law effectively banned handguns, automatic firearms, and high-capacity semi-automatic weapons. Police officers were exempt from the provisions of the law, etc. Then they go on, right? This is back in 1976. Then they say, in June of 2008, in a closely watched, far-reaching decision, the Supreme Court of the United States struck down the D.C. law, ruling that it violated the Second Amendment to the Constitution. Okay? That's what they said in 2008. That's the very famous District of Columbia versus Heller case.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They often called the Heller case. Now, what they're doing with that, and you've even got lawyers like Alan Dershowitz, who a lot of conservatives respect, but they don't realize the guy is a liberal. There's no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
They argue in that 2008, what the Supreme Court did, they say, was they ruled that the right to bear arms pertains to an individual. All right? Because it does, because of the Second Amendment. Now, of course, that's logical. It's consistent with the entire history of our country. In fact, I usually point people to another court case called Nunn versus the State of Georgia from the year 1846. I would highly recommend going, I won't read the whole thing, but just in short, what they determined in Nunn versus the State of Georgia, they had passed a law somewhere, a ban against carrying a handgun concealed. And the case went to court, and the court ruled that the right of the people to keep and bear arms is not a right for the militia. It's a right of the people, not the militia. You see what I'm saying? Because that's the wording. Because they try to go in and argue that, well, this has to do with a well-regulated militia, so it's the right of the militia, really. And no, the courts have already ruled on that. And they've said, no, it's the right of the people. Well, what Alan Dershowitz and these other liberals are trying to do is they're trying to argue that in our country, that the Second Amendment never pertained to individuals until the year 2008.
All right, folks, that's the end of the interview for the radio show. You can find the rest of the 30 minutes worth of the interview that will hopefully be up on the YouTube and Rumble channel, also be on the Patreon channel. Thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Doug Thornton. You've been listening to the American Vindicta Show. I'm out of here. All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.